Chapter 26. Hollis. He closed his eyes. He opened his eyes. The room came into focus slowly, its corners mere suggestions, its shadow and light playing a sly game of keep away from his perception, such as it was. Hollis lay on his back, blinking so slowly as to suggest that his eyelids moved only as a function of air pressure, opening and closing in syncopated relation to the rise and fall of his lungs, moving the sheet beneath his chin like a starched white tide. He closed his eyes. He opened his eyes. His pulse surged subrhythmically in a dull, throbbing pain in the back of his head, at the place where his spinal column entered his brain. Too much wine, he thought, and then corrected himself familiarly. Not enough food. Up too late. He closed his eyes. He opened his eyes. He had dreamt of water. A sun-streaked, lily-strewn koi pond on the sculpted estate of Akahito Takata. Floating with his arms out like a Christ-shaped bubble of air on the surface. Susan on the shore, amid pink and lavender bonsais, holding her knees, watching him float, watching his solitude, admiring his peace. He closed his eyes, ladling back into the dream. He opened his eyes. And then there had been a lake, Buckeye Lake. David and Tilly on the shore. David crossing his arms, watching him fish, watching him bait a hook with a golf ball. Tilly holding a fish, holding a fishbowl full of water. Where are the fish? Heinrich Van Susteren, yelling and pointing inexplicably, still upset after all these years. And then a swimming pool. Back at UNOH, the Fighting Dog Stars, swimming the anchor leg in the state regional championships. People along the edges of the pool, the entire commercial loan department, standing, dancing, watching him power through the water, chanting, "Wally, Wally." Wally Nunn, swimming over into his lane. Fat, newly retired Wally, who was never even a part of his college experience, splashing into his lane in great sloppy slaps at the water, obstructing his rhythm. Wally, swimming in a rumpled suit, stroking with one hand and holding a drink in the other, slapping him in the face with his fat leather-shod feet. Women chanting, "Kevin, Kevin," and from the left it had been casual Friday cowboy Kevin with his long hair and his thigh-tie bandana, pushing the water behind him with handfuls of mail, catching him in the temple with a boot. He closed his eyes. He opened his eyes, swimming down to escape, down to the bottom of the pool where the chanting was low and garbled and distant, and he had been alone again, looking up to the watery light and the effulgent explosions of air with each kick of Wally's shoes. And then all was calm, a gently shifting surface above him, suddenly pocked with the soft explosions of rain. And he had dreamt he was at the bottom of the ocean, looking up into an endless, darkening sky of gray water. The shadow of a rowboat had floated into view with its oars stroking the surface like tendrils, then dipping below, twisting in the filtered light, looking for him, reaching for him, reaching for him. He closed his eyes. The sheet pulled sideways across his chest as the form on the edge of his awareness shifted and rolled away from him. He opened his eyes. Bethany. Beth. Beth. She was suddenly everywhere in his mind, flooding the memory of his senses. Sight, sound, smell, touch, and taste, all comparing notes and reproducing her vividly, and with such urgency that she existed completely within a single thought. The thought swelled and bulged and glistened in imagined light like a perfectly ripened dew-streaked fruit beginning to split its own skin for the burgeoning volume of sun-sweetened juice that cannot reasonably be contained. He closed his eyes. The pulse at the back of his head loosened its grip and moved south, rolling its way toward certain tumescent destiny with a momentum that altogether ruined the harmony between eyelids and lungs. He kept them closed. She had been exquisite in the dark, against the windows, her skin made of the moon, her burning blonde hair, her bright body rising and falling in a landscape of perfection, the hills and valleys of her youth that had taken the breath from his lungs. For the first time since regaining consciousness, Hollis came alive. And it was here that Elemental Hydraulics started his day. He was masculine, vital, even still. He closed his eyes tighter to keep her in, to keep her from escaping. He imagined that he was still dreaming, reaching upward in his mind for the boat, arms outstretched, swimming. Susan flicked the sheet away and padded off to the bathroom. Hollis squinted his eyes tighter, trying to seal the water inside. Swimming up. Swimming up. Reaching for the outstretched oar that had become a hand, supple and smooth and gloved in filtered blue light. But urination, with its distinctive echo, like tiny wet shards of metal scattered across the tile of the bathroom, and then, inevitably, the bellowing flush of the toilet. Foosh! Drained from his head the magic water of dreaming. Hollis suddenly came current with the world in which he lived. It was early morning, and he was home. He opened an eye in time to catch his wife wearing the crewneck pink cotton nightgown she had owned for 158 years, turning out the bathroom light and heading back for the bed. She was not looking at him, and he did not, therefore, look away or pretend to be asleep. He regarded her with objective detachment. She was an old woman, he thought to himself. No, not old. Older. Older than she had been. Because if she was old, then, chronologically speaking, he was certainly old. And he was not old. Age, or the only component of age that really mattered, was a function of self-conception. It was all in the power of the mind to shape what one was. One was as one believed. He did not believe himself to be old, and so he wasn't. He gripped himself with a slow, clandestine squeeze so as not to draw her attention. He was hard as a rock, by God. He was vital. He was positively vital. He wasn't even in the same neighborhood as old. But Susan, somewhere along the line, his wife had grown older. Older than she had been. Older than she should be. Her face, sans makeup, without the contrivances of expression, in all the honesty of the morning, showed a woman growing old. A woman giving up. A woman resigned to the pull of gravity in a steep downhill slide into the grave. A woman looking for nothing in life but the opportunity to feel old and to feel tired and to feel aggrieved and to be done with it all. She often said her age gave her character. To hell with character, he thought. Character in the face, character in the eyes, the look of experience. All excuses for those who refuse to acknowledge that we are but a product of what we believe about ourselves. Character. Where was the vitality? Where was the goddamn by-the-balls joie de vivre? Susan grabbed her pillow and sat on the edge of the bed. Hollis looked at the curve of his wife's back, at the pliable ridge of spine beneath the cloth of her nightgown like a taut, knotted rope. She sat quietly with the pillow in her lap, unaware of him entirely, probably contemplating whether to get up or sleep another couple hours. Susan had known vitality once. She had once known where the balls of life could be found. She had known how to shock him, how to keep him off balance. She had been full of it once, absolutely full of it. She had been a force of nature. Incredibly, there had been a day when he thought his value in Susan's life was as an advocate for maturity. He had modeled for her a conservative sensibility born of experience that he did not really possess, and that he would not possess for a very long time. This was back when she still had another 2 years at Kent State, and he was newly out in the world, wearing a cheap polyester suit and gaudy ties, selling cookie-cutter, split-level versions of the American dream to one family at a time. He had modeled for Susan an attitude of belonging, of entitlement, as though born within the private chambers of a society that did not yet even know his name. He had acted like he owned the real estate to which he had access, as though the homes were all part of his own private kingdom. He made a point of taking her to a different home every week, many of them not really his to show, slipping a silver key into the lock and pushing open the door. He did not carry her across any thresholds, but the effect was almost the same. It was as though they were all his to give away and she could have her pick. "It's all a matter of buckling down, Susan," he had told her once while out to dinner in Columbus. "It's not too early to start making your mark in the business world. Teaching is keen, okay? It is, but there's no money in teaching. Business is where it's at. You'd be great at anything, selling real estate like me, or interior design. Or, shoot, the way you cook, you could go into the restaurant business. Think about it. Kimball's Diner, or Sue's Place, or maybe, just maybe." And here he had reached across the table and folded his hand over hers. "Susan John's Bar and Grill." He had let the name hang in the air for a moment, dangling the future possibilities before her, business and marriage intertwined like part of the same glittery plaything, and then raced on before she could respond. "It's not too late to change your major, and in the meantime you could start making your mark by working small jobs in the right field." But Susan had been too full of herself to take his lesson in fake it till you make it entrepreneurialism. Her idealism had gotten in the way of anything so practical as a lucrative career. Idealism, that is, with no small amount of assistance from Lyndon Johnson, Spiro Agnew, Richard Nixon, James Earl Ray. Poverty, racism, the entire southeastern quadrant of the continent of Asia, and more than just a little Mary Jane. It was not, he had long since concluded, so much a love of politics as a love of herself in politics that had motivated her. It was the idea in her head of making a difference, and a sense of herself as the critical participant in whatever harebrained scheme her fellow flower children decided on a whim would change the world. Kent State was hardly a counterculture stronghold, consisting mostly of conservative to neo-political white middle-class torchbearers of mainstream American values. Consequently, Susan's political consciousness came to life beneath the yoke of a general complacence that easily deferred to the status quo and that tended to distort even modest public demonstrations, a march of 30 sign-waving students across the campus, or a 2-hour sympathetic sit-in at Taylor Hall, or a windshield leaflet campaign, as heroic battles of epic proportions. A little drama went a long way at Kent State and tended to pay big emotional dividends for Susan. Transforming the daughter of God-fearing Nancy and Herb Kimball of Dearborn, Michigan, into Ohio's own Joan of Arc. Susan pulled the tendrils of hair back from her face and then fluffed and replaced the pillow, slipping her legs and bare feet back beneath the sheets. She rolled onto her side, tugging the covers as she went, physically connecting with him through a tension of fabric. He pulled back slightly, not knowing why. She sighed. They had been an improbable pair, to say the least. Hollis had pursued a business degree at the University of Northwestern Ohio, back when it was still the Northwestern School of Commerce, with an eye toward all the traditional markers and trappings of success. A nice home. A nice car. A nice pension. Approving parents. An upper class of society that respected him. Susan, by contrast, had pursued a teaching degree at Kent State with an eye toward changing the world, peace, love, harmony, equality, and a society without classes. Where Hollis was emotionally reserved, Susan was prone to emotional lability. Where Hollis tended toward introspection, expressing only that which had been polished and sculpted for public consumption, Susan tended to express herself in the moment without any regard for the quality of the thought or how it might be perceived. Where Hollis forced himself forward in the world, driven by a quiet internal pressure to succeed and to be accepted, Susan allowed herself to gravitate, as if in free float, toward the people and things that she loved. Susan enjoyed marijuana. Hollis did not. Hollis wore underwear. Susan did not. But, however improbable, Susan had loved him. Even barefoot and braless and well before the dew was off the lily of her idealism, she had loved him. In his more candid moments, this affection had always baffled him, although it never stopped him from accepting it as genuine. In the early years, Hollis tended to explain Susan's attraction for him rather self-deprecatingly as a triumph of shallow physicality over all matters of substance. It was a triumph of genetics. He was a competitive swimmer. She had seen his shoulders and his arms and his thighs and his dripping bare chest. She had seen him win the 200-meter butterfly, leading the fighting UNOH Dog Stars to victory against her home team. She had seen him push himself effortlessly out of the pool in his starburst trunks, slicking back his dark curls as she sat demurely with the other freshmen in the bleachers, her nascent political consciousness still swaddled in her brain like an unexploded bomb. Had they met under other circumstances, maybe 2 years later, after her brain had taken full control, he probably would never have appealed to her. She probably would have hated him. But Hollis had gotten in line early when the chemistry of attraction was the only consideration. Biology, he had told himself, had been given a head start, and by the time Susan's conscience began evaluating the world, he had the unfair advantages of momentum and a relative exemption from scrutiny. But in later years, when Hollis's success in the world of high finance began to solidify itself as a reality, rather than as spit and a prayer masquerading as reality, Hollis began to explain Susan's early attraction for him somewhat differently. Shallow physicality and the unfair head start had certainly been a part of it. But he suspected that Susan must have perceived, even if only subconsciously, that his shoulder muscles disguised something greater within. Some part of her must have smelled the success for which he was destined, as though she admired in advance who he was to become and what he was to make of himself. She must have suspected that her free-to-be-you-and-me, pot-smoking, protesting, neighbor-loving, earth-mother-muffin, age-of-Aquarius ethic was an indulgence of youth not meant to last, and that it would leave her disheartened, unhappy, and in need of a strong, sobering cup of coffee that she would be too poor to afford whenever the well-meaning delusions of that era gave way to reality. Hollis believed that something in Susan always understood that he was her safety net, and that whatever happened in Cambodia, whoever really killed John, Bobby, and Martin, and whatever the fate of Dr. King's dream, he would be there to catch her in the end. And that end would be a beginning. Their beginning. And he would wait for it. He would wait her out. He would be with her, on her terms, until she was ready to let go. And then they would begin. And somehow, Susan had understood that. She must have. Something in her must have understood that he, Hollis Johns, was more solid, more enduring than anything else in her life. She must have known that Hollis could simply see farther than she could, that he knew what lay beyond her own horizon. She must have known that she had the luxury to abandon herself to the grandiose delusions of youth, as long as he was there to catch her, when the unstable earth beneath her feet betrayed her trust. She must have known that he would be there to reel her back in when it was time to grow up. He, the voice of wisdom and maturity. He, the patient man who loved her enough to wait for her until the world stopped turning. In the meantime, she must have known in the unconscious way that we know things, that he would grow up to be enough for both of them, and would work uncommonly hard to soften the ground for their future. And when the time came, she did need him, and he did catch her. He caught her and reeled her back in just as she knew he would, just as surely as if she had been a prize rainbow trout swimming in Buckeye Lake, believing it to be the entire universe. That their courtship was on again, off again, was not a surprise to either of them, or to any of their friends. They were too different to reasonably expect anything else. Every so often, things would unravel. Misunderstandings would harden, differences would sharpen, and they would argue to an intermission. Usually, the precipitating event came as a political discussion that devolved headlong into an exercise in comparative shortcomings. His naive deference to the leanings of culture and power, her hyper-cynical distrust of authority, and naive allegiance to the allegedly disenfranchised. His alcohol, her pot, his ties, her lack of underwear. They would split for 2 or 3 months at a time, each dating other people, always from their own respective tribes. For her, fellow student activists, thin, stringy-haired things who wrote bad poetry and masturbated guitars and talked a good game about the evils of the world. And for him, a series of slightly older women in the working world beyond college life. A waitress. A secretary at the office of the UNOH registrar. A summer clerk who worked for the agency that employed him. For Hollis, these intermittent dalliances had always been undertaken, at least initially, with a peculiar sense of relief. The relief of solitude. The relief of not having to bargain for his own identity. These women, who in his memory were now but a single, apolitical, shape-shifting, not-so-smart amalgam he conceptualized as the women who were not Susan, had given him whatever he wanted, believed whatever he believed, without question or resistance or doubt. If the amalgam had had any ambition at all, a dubious proposition, then he, big-shouldered, college-educated, mogul-in-the-making Hollis Johns, had been that sole ambition. He was the answer to the looming question of the future, and, accordingly, the women of the amalgam were believers in whatever he believed. Not critical believers, but grateful believers, drinking in every drop of attention he would deign to give them, and, in return, giving him back confirmation of everything he believed about himself. The not Susans offered all the ease and comfort of dating a gender-reversed mirror, not so much because they were genuine approximations of Hollis, but because they offered nothing of substance that might distort his own reflection. And this, compared with Susan Kimball, made them easy and a relief. But relief always melted into ennui. After several weeks, usually just when his relationship with the not Susan was emerging into the realm of sexual possibility, Hollis lost all interest. His erstwhile attraction hissing out of the equation altogether like air from a punctured raft. As the not Susan swirled its wine and licked its lips and found his ankle beneath the table, Hollis was discovering the intensity with which he wanted out. From that point, it was only a matter of 2 or 3 weeks of going through the motions before he got his wish, during which time he touted the importance of sexual restraint before marriage as a necessary counterweight to the out-of-control, free-love culture. The not-Susan amalgam always emphatically agreed, of course, not understanding that sexual abstinence would soon prove an insufficient counterweight, and that all the virtues of a purely platonic relationship would need to be added before Hollis would be satisfied that he was doing enough to save American culture. And then he would simply disappear. Hollis generally tried not to think of how Susan had felt about him during the intermissions in their courtship. Such musings always seemed to lead him into speculation about just how free Susan had been with herself in those years. Given the culture she tended to celebrate in those times, he wondered whether the intermittent freedoms from their relationship had meant freedom to explore multiple lovers, abandoning her restraint, ceding her control to the lure of convenience and spontaneity and stringy-haired musical masturbators. He knew that many of Susan's fellow flower children desired her. He was not a flower child, but he was also not blind. And there had been the looks and the gratuitous touches that no one could really disguise, even when he and his big shoulders were around. He also knew that Susan was naturally affectionate, trusting, and dangerously open to the unscripted moment. Inevitably, knowing this about Susan led Hollis to fear how faithful, how experimental, she had been during the times that they were not actually seeing each other. Those thoughts, strangely even now, were like small, unpleasant currents delivered to tender places in his chest, and he invariably backtracked in his ruminations to find a more comfortable path through the maze of memory. But somehow he and Susan always found a way back to each other, the intermittent dalliances all crumbling to dust, barely diverting them from a relationship that was destined to go the distance. He had been accepted, grudgingly at first, and then as a noble act of tolerance, into her circle of friends. His inclusion would never have been possible, of course, without Susan's good word. But the real truth of it was that Hollis had simply been too charming to resist. They were all good and ready to hate him, and his clean-cut athletic looks and his barrel chest did not help matters much, suggesting that, in a world in need of radical change, Hollis was far more likely to be a part of the problem than a part of the solution. But hating Hollis had turned out to be as unrealistic as changing the world. Affability was probably the greatest gift Homer Johns had ever given to his older son. The old machinist, who had dropped out of school and struck out on his own at age 16, was not a smart man by any means. But Homer had known how to run a business in a small town. He had known in his marrow how to connect with other people, and he had survived the world by his talent with metal and by the sheer force of his personality. To know Homer was to like him, instantly. Hollis and his younger brother Clayton and his younger sister Mirabel all grew up with an innate understanding of how to revive dead John Deere combines and how to unlock the doors of the world with a smile and a word, usually strung together into some kind of apocryphal anecdote. Homer Johns had found the mother of his children without a penny to his name. She was the lovely Mary Ann Easley, whose father, none other than the venerable Ben Easley, owned Cincinnati Pulp Incorporated. Those who really knew Homer would have predicted him to marry up, and they might have foreseen that his charm would ultimately provide for a brood of well-fed and educated children who took after their father. So, as it had been with Homer, it was not possible to dislike Hollis Johns. Susan's flower brigade soon learned that Hollis knew how to tell a good story and a good joke. He'd argue with them one minute and defend them the next with equal vigor. And one by one, they understood that Hollis was one of those people about whom it is said, often in some compensatory way, that he would give the shirt off his back. The arguments, usually in the commons or out on the lawn on the hill beneath Taylor Hall or in someone's room, were epic. The Aquarian flower children assailing God and country, Hollis advocating a degree of deference to the government that they could not stomach. But in time, the differences in politics and intoxicants did not deter a genuine and mutual affection. To Hollis, Susan's friends were well-meaning and honorable, however misguided and naive. To the Aquarian flower children, Hollis Johns was well-meaning and honorable, however misguided and naive. That, and they each claimed to their credit, an abiding loyalty and affection for the lovely, spirited, and infectiously effervescent Susan Kimball. They loved her, and he loved her, desperately. More than all of them combined, he loved her. When they were together, particularly after a separation, his life took on a glittered, hyper-oxygenated quality that left him feeling slightly out of control, Susan had an air of unpredictability and danger about her, like she would do anything. Like she was so full of energy that unless she channeled it into some shocking or profound act of love or generosity or protest or anger or declaration of enthusiasm for living, she would combust into flame. She was easily the most attractive girl he had ever met, and while that might not have been true in any objective sense, her eyes were bright but slightly asymmetrical. Her nose was a little large. Her ears were a little small. He found her physically irresistible, and her manner intoxicating. He closed his eyes. Hollis remembered those days like he recalled Columbus carnivals on hot nights at the threshold of his adolescence. He felt the covers of the bed pressing in over his body, and he tested their weight. Once, twice, three times. Clenching the muscles in his groin until the covers lifted, albeit imperceptibly, near his waist. Susan had generally indulged his identity as a budding real estate mogul, and, to some conscious or unconscious extent, she may have actually believed in the inevitability of his success. But Hollis was honest enough with himself, now, all these decades later, to know that his professional potential was only a minor note in the strange and beautiful score to their courtship. He understood that the underlying melody binding them together had really come from Susan's genuine openness to possibility, from her embrace of every potential that life had to offer at that particular crossroads. In Susan's world, there was very little slippage between what could happen and what did happen, between believing and being. Raw potential filled every singular moment to the bursting point, transforming ordinary experience into almost magical events. Love under a full moon on the grassy slope beneath Taylor Hall. Picnics under a blue sky at Miller's Quarry. Fishing the bounty of Buckeye Lake. Skinny dipping in Colony Creek. Weekend road trips to Chicago for the Rolling Stones and Jefferson Airplane and Buffalo Springfield. Magical events that linked together in his mind, filling an entire era of his life. Looking through her eyes, even extraordinary things had been possible. Wise, prescient real estate moguls were possible. Teaching an antidote to poverty and violence was possible. A wealth with which to build charitable, politically conscious empires was possible. Landing and walking on the moon were possible. World peace, racial equality. He could love her and she could love him deeply and forever. Extraordinary things. The clock next to him burst to life.
American body count in the past 30 days threatens to exceed that in any month since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Administration officials have uniformly declined to comment on reports that...
Hollis turned off the alarm with a deftly delivered slap. Susan moved slightly next to him, but the rhythm of her breathing resumed, unbroken. It was 6:30. He assumed that she had gone to bed the previous evening, angry, alone and angry. He had stolen into the bedroom after 2 o'clock, naked for having undressed in the hallway, and after laying his clothes over the back of the chair, he had slipped carefully, imperceptibly, beneath the sheets, as though he weighed less than one of the feathers in his pillow. Susan had not moved, and if she had been pretending to be asleep, then she had been convincing, right down to the slackened face and the softly burbling snore that tended to follow a bottle of wine. She had been full of it once, he marveled in memory. But somewhere back there, at some point, unnoticed by either of them, Susan had surrendered. She had surrendered to an inevitability of her own making. And now, like a fruit long since pulled from the vine, that inevitability was starting to show on her face, and in her posture, and in her walk. The way she brushed her hair and ate her food. The laugh was still intact, still like an open flame that could set fire to the furniture when she got going. The laugh and the open smile. The last to go. But these were very rare treats indeed, timid animals living in thick woods that could be coaxed out into the open, only with great effort. If she had gone to bed angry, it was because she had indulged in the childish assumption that he, her husband, had abandoned her little telephone party to run off and have his way with Bethany Cohen. If she had gone to bed angry, it was because she had cast herself in the role of Beth's competitor, and then declared herself the loser at the hands of an unfaithful husband and her own adolescent imagination. Had she stopped for only a second to consider it, she would have known the very idea to be preposterous. It was not that the idea was preposterous because he was an undesirable man. He no longer had the swimmer's physique or the wavy dark hair of his youth, and certainly not the starburst swim trunks. But he was still, obviously, quite desirable, even to someone like Beth, who could have her pick of any man she wanted. Nor was the idea preposterous because Beth was either undesirable or unwilling. She was, obviously, highly desirable. As all his former OFSC colleagues, many of his friends, and his son David could now attest. And as to willing, well, there were no longer any doubts about that. Rather, Susan's assumptions were preposterous because they failed to account for his character. They wrongly assumed in him a lack of control and a certain baseness that, in other moods, he might have found insulting. She should have known that his intentions concerning Bethany had always been honorable. That she, Susan Kimball Johns, was his wife, and that Bethany Cohen was not his wife, nor his lover, but merely the daughter of a benefactor and friend. Where was the faith? Where was the trust? No. He opened his eyes. No. Screw faith. Screw trust. Where was her knowledge of his character? Had she simply not been paying attention all these years, she should know him to be above that sort of thing. She should know at least that much. He closed his eyes. But if she did not know, well, then he was not insulted. Her assumptions about him, if indeed she harbored such assumptions, were prosaic and a little sad. But he chose not to be insulted, for life was all about choices, even emotion, even perception. And he chose not to pull a long face and to be insulted. He chose instead to see his wife as a victim. Not a victim of a philandering husband, because she did not have a philandering husband, but rather a victim of her own insecurity. A victim of her own choices. Most significantly, her own choice to be a victim. But back in the day, my oh my, how different she had been. Back in the day, Susan had been anything but a victim. If anything, she had suffered from an overestimation of her own power and independence. Naive, yes, to a fault. There was no denying that. But absolutely self-possessed. A free agent. Confident in her own sexual allure. And at the same time, disarmingly innocent about most things. She pulled you in. Made you want to tell her things, show her things, explain the truth about the world. And you did it. Chest stuck out, making up most of it as you went along. Geopolitics, economics, business, cycling property values, deigning to explain the truth about the world to her as she listened intently, tucking ribbons of silky blonde hair behind her ears. Leaning forward so you can smell the faint residue of soap on her skin as the pink pads of her toes burrowed down into the cool grass, or down into the shore mud along Buckeye Lake, or down into the towels and clothing piled into the bottom of the skiff. You did it, and she soaked it up, and you felt like a man. Like an explorer planting flags in uncharted territory, declaring entire continents of her understanding as your own. and dazzling the natives. And when she leaned in to kiss you, pressing the warm flesh of her mouth into yours, pulling you forward like you are weightless, pulling you down on top of her, down into the grass or the cool lake mud or the cottony bottom of the skiff. It is all your doing, and all because of you, because you have shown her the way, and because you are great and she is grateful. And for a split second, as you settle over her and close your eyes, drinking her into your senses, it occurs to you that your heart is racing and that you have lost control and that she has been leading you from the very first moment. Hollis gripped himself again, firmly this time, like he was opening up an F-18 over the desert. His circumference swelled and throbbed against the added pressure of his palm, and he felt a surge in his chest, like he had vitality to spare. More than enough for Susan, he thought, if she would only take it from him. If she would only relax enough to allow it to happen, he could show her the way back. He could show her the optimism she had lost to her belief in inevitability. He could reunite her with the inner glow and the humor and the spontaneity and the lust for existence. It was possible, he thought, barrel rolling the F-18 down along the desert floor, because inevitability was a cheap parlor trick, because one was only as one believed. She would have to let him in. She would have to trust him enough to lead her. She would need to lay down her arms. She would need to stop lashing at him and criticizing him for following his own rhythm, a rhythm she had once loved and that had slowly grown alien to her. The naysaying and the finding of fault and the resurrection of old grievances would have to stop. He could lead. He would lead. He was her husband, and he would lead. But she had to be willing to follow. He would open himself to her. He would present himself without defenses. He would admit fault wherever appropriate, and he would give all credit due, and then some. He would soften all the ground between them. But Susan would have to be willing to follow. He opened his eyes. Hollis was now wide awake and fully engorged, flush with the prospect of a new beginning, of a continuation of an old beginning. The answer was suddenly staring him in the face, too simple, elegant, and timeless to be wrong. With a snap of his wrist, he billowed up the sheets like a mainsail catching the wind and rolled in toward his wife. He scooted in so that his chest curved over the bowing of her back and his knees tucked in behind her own. She, too, must have been awake and thinking. Her muscles contracted instantly, hardening her body to his, as if to a cold wind or a touch of ice. He had expected this reaction. After all, it had been a very long time, and it was a reasonable response under the circumstances. He would not hold this autonomic aversion reaction against her. He would hold nothing against her but his own body and his desire to reintroduce her to what she had forgotten about him and about herself. He would hold against her nothing more or less than the joy of life itself, starting now. It would take courage to make the first move, to break the ice. And if she could not take the first step, then he would do it. He would risk the rejection. He would instigate, and she would have to deal with it. Whatever came, he would endure it for the sake of the bigger picture. And in the end, she would thank him. In the end, she would be Susan Kimball once again, free and happy and full of it. Full of it again. And she would welcome him back. In the end, she would greet him as a hero and a liberator. He found the hem of her nightgown with his fingers and very slowly pulled it up her body. With a mind of its own, the tip of him found the flesh of her bottom, poking it with unintended deliberation, like a child might poke a balloon with a stick. He deftly adjusted himself, so the full length of his shaft laid snugly along the crease where one of her thighs lay upon the other. There it felt heavy and thick and potent. He was vital, by God. Vital. Retired my ass, he thought. I'm just getting started. He tightened the muscles in his groin. His penis angled inward in a sharp, pulsing thrust against her, slipping slightly further into the crease. He placed a hand on the top of her leg and squeezed again. Another pulse. And this time... Honestly, Hollis... Susan threw back the sheet, sat up, and walked into the bathroom, closing the door. In a minute, the shower started. Hollis lay in bed, dick in his hand, listening. It was an understandable reaction, he told himself. Really. Anything else would have been a surprise. This would take some time. It would take some patience. But she would respond. She would respond to him. The erection left him as she had, unceremoniously and much quicker than he had expected. Hollis climbed out of bed, grabbed his bathrobe and padded out of the bedroom and downstairs to his study. Except for the ever more faint running of the shower, the house was quiet. He grabbed his meditation mat from its tube behind the door, turned and headed back upstairs for his place behind the sofa, looking out into the backyard. He disrobed. He unrolled the mat. He sat. He skipped the warm-up. He was plenty warmed up already. He contorted himself straight into the full lotus, pulling at his ankles like he was trying to fold a dead body into a trunk. He closed his eyes. He meditated. He tried to meditate. He visualized the light that outshines all light. He visualized the walls melting away. He told himself again and again and again that he was at peace. At peace. At peace. But he was not at peace. He opened his eyes. There was way too much in the way of the singularity this morning. He looked out onto the backyard, shadowless and wet with rain. A wind was blowing small yellow leaves across the grass. For the first time in the unseasonably warm autumn, it was easy for him to imagine that winter was not but a few weeks off. Two robins hopped about, jabbing their beaks intermittently into the ground, every so often cocking their heads at him, the Buddha in the living room window. It would have been beneath him to be angry, a sign that he was out of control. So he was not angry. He was frustrated, true. Physically frustrated, but anger was not a part of his emotional lexicon, and so he was not angry. Nor was he hurt. Regardless of what her motivations might have been, to embarrass, to belittle, to humiliate, Susan's rejection of him was not an emotional event for him. It was all unfolding as he had expected. She was reacting out of fear, that was all. Susan was fine. All in good time. He closed his eyes. He refocused, flooding his mind with bright light, melting walls, feeling the vibration, the humming from deep within the iron core of the earth. Not so much feeling it, for we all feel it. The vibration of creation that buzzes through our bones every second of our lives, as connecting with it, allowing it to be the organizing force that governs our existence at a molecular level. The key, said the scholars on the shelves in his study, was to stop resisting this singular vibrational truth. As the earth is in harmony with the cosmos, so we must tune ourselves to the earth. The key was resonation. Not resignation. Resonation. Harmonic convergence with the universe, with the truth. All pain came from resistance, from fighting the vibration that was truth. The vibration started in his buttocks, which were pressed against the straw reeds of his genuine $49.99 Indian straw meditation master mat. Although always contemporaneous with the refrigerator cycling on, Hollis knew that the ultra-low, barely perceptible buzz slowly circling his perineum and alighting hesitantly upon his coccyx was not the refrigerator. It was the beginning of resonance. Resonance. That introduced genuine meditative consciousness. The vibration, as it always did, radiated outward from the coccyx, up along the spine, outward in symmetrical fashion along the left and right femur toward the knee joints, and also down along the base of his scrotum. And thus came the inherent conflict for Hollis with vibrational meditation. This last dipping, scooping, cupping flange of the vibration introduced, rather than a genuine meditative consciousness, thoughts with a much higher potential for anti-transcendental distraction. In particular, this morning, the vibrations through his nether regions induced thoughts of Bethany Cohen. Standing naked, backlit by moonlight pouring into the windows of the Westin Hotel. The walls around him did not melt away, but instead were replaced by the walls of room 713. Bethany's face was serene and welcoming. Her arms were open, extended in the bleach-blue light, as though she were reaching for him beneath the surface of moonlit water. Had he kissed her? He had kissed her. By God, he had kissed her. She had kissed him anyway, long and deep and full on the lips, and he had not pulled away. So he had kissed her, with her arms around him. She had pressed her beautiful, nubile body, every naked inch of the body that had turned so many heads that night. She had pressed it against his own body, standing on her toes so that she could touch her mouth to his, so that she could slip the very tip of her tongue delicately along the inside of his upper lip. And he had not pulled away. And when she had pulled back the covers on the bed and slipped beneath them, pulling his face down toward hers by the necktie, Hollis Johns, son of Homer and Marianne, father of David, Tilly, and Ben, husband of Susan, friend of Akihito Takada, had leaned in and kissed Bethany Cohen on the cheek, pulled the covers over her exquisite golden breasts, brushed her forehead gently with the backs of his fingers, and, with a casual good night belied by everything that had just transpired, walked out of the room. He did not remember driving home. Not a single turn or stoplight. Ordinarily, this might have suggested something about the quantity of alcohol he had consumed over the course of the evening and its two vaguely connected parties. Someone might rightly suggest that he should not have been driving at all. A lecture from Susan on that subject was still not out of the question. But if alcohol was a contributing factor in depriving him of a memory of the drive home, it was not the main culprit. He had not really been present for the drive home. He had left his mind and all of its life-recording, memory-making capacity back in room 713, where it replayed a 90-second loop of his existence that was as endless as it was brief. It began with the sight of Bethany on the far side of the bed, dress slipping past her waist. It ended with his hand on her forehead. Then it started over again. Now, as he sat naked behind his couch, universal vibrations thrumming out along his genitals, Hollis reconnected with the emotion that, until now, had been lost. It all came flooding back, not as a 90-second cinematic loop, but as a sensorial wave. The smell of her hair and her skin, the taste of her mouth, the pressure of the contours of her body fitting snugly into the contours of his own body, the feeling of warm flesh through cotton, the strain of her muscles as she raised herself to him, up, up, arching those perfect feet to bring her mouth to his, the toned thigh sliding inevitably between his legs as she steadied herself against him, the smell of her breath and the sound of it leaving her body and rushing back in like the breathing of the ocean. For meditative purposes, the moment was not a total loss. There is something mildly transcendental in the erotic daydream. Not enough for one to commune with the elusive singularity, but certainly sufficient to loose the moorings and drift a bit from the here and now. If Hollis had some vague appreciation for the state of his arousal, he was altogether unaware of the slowly rhythmic, manual assistance he was providing.
"Hollis, what on earth?"
He opened his eyes. Susan stood looking over the back of the couch in her pink terrycloth robe, her mouth agape.
What are you doing?
Hollis dropped his penis to the carpet, unfolding himself, reaching back for his robe and his unflappable, even if a little perturbed at your lack of worldliness, demeanor.
"I'm meditating," he said calmly, ramming his arms through the sleeves.
"Meditating? That looks a whole lot like masturbating to me, Hollis. And in front of the living room windows, what has gotten into you? I don't even..."
"Relax, Susan, relax. It's our yard. No one is out there but the birds. Just..."
"You know the mowers will be here today?"
"Not until 10. If they come at all, it's been raining all morning."
"Hollis, what time the mowers arrive is hardly the point."
"I didn't bring up the mowers. Seems to me that you brought up the mowers. So, what exactly is the point?"
"The point is, what do you think you are doing sitting naked behind the couch, jerking off in front of the windows?"
"Oh, Christ."
Hollis stood up and fastened his robe with a sharp, two-handed yank on the belt. He was still rather dramatically at attention, and the robe tented ridiculously outward over the back of the couch, toward his wife. He tugged at the fabric in irritation, perhaps not realizing that the sideways big-top look was, under the circumstances, far less awkward and dramatic than the sudden jack-in-the-box little angry man leaping from behind a curtain moment.
"J'accuse!"
it seemed to declare, wildly, swaying and bobbing like a drunken sailor. Hollis pretended not to notice, doing his best to hold his wife's eyes to his own by ratcheting up the emotion in his face. It might have worked. Except that it was hard not to notice that now he and the little drunken sailor were both angry and accusing.
"That's just plain ignorance, Susan. You have no idea what you're talking about. I wasn't jerking off, as you put it. Don't pretend to know what you don't understand. This is a daily, mind-expanding exercise for me. It's very relaxing. It improves peace of mind. It improves focus. I don't expect you to understand. It is a meditative process. It takes 45 minutes to an hour. I try to do this very early in the mornings while you and Ben are still asleep to spare you, and me, precisely this scene."
"Every morning?"
she asked, incredulously.
"Every morning, 45 minutes to an hour. And spare me the attitude. When you have studied meditation like I have studied meditation, we can talk. Until then..."
"If I studied meditation like you've apparently studied meditation, Hollis, I'd go through 2 cases of batteries a week. Have you completely lost your mind?"
Hollis was through talking. He bent to the floor, rolled up his meditation mat, stepped out from behind the sofa, and charged past her across the living room, the angry sailor warning everything in his path to stand back and let him be. Susan took heed and stepped out of his way, saying nothing.